great. He's got one over his left hand, one beautiful mouth. He's a random.
Now, 6 o'clock, we'll be calling the October 9th work session for the Planning Commission to order. First item of business is the Pledge of Allegiance, followed by a moment of silence. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you.
Next item of business is the planning director's comments.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any comments this time.
Thank you. Next item of business is public comment section. Anyone wishing to come forward to speak to any of the items of the county, you can come forward to the pedestal, state your name and address. You'll be limited to 3 minutes. Seeing no one coming forward, we will end the public comment section and go right into our work session, which is discussion of the capital improvement plan years 2020 through 2024.
Mr. Robinson, would you care to explain the Planning Commission how this year's procedures the policies are all going to work as far as how we go and bring the capital improvement plan the next couple of years?
Okay. We're following a similar format that we have for the last several years. As you know, the CIP comes up once a year for your review as required by state code. So tonight is just informational. It's not the public hearing. We plan to have that in December. So tonight we have representatives from the various departments that submitted requests. They're here to discuss and explain to you, give some background on the requests. You'll actually do the ranking in your November meeting, and if you complete that, then the public hearing will take place in December.
And the order, as far as the order, we typically we do the school system and emergency services first, and then we get to other county agencies. I know we have representatives from both here.
Okay. Would somebody from the school system like to come forward?
First, absolutely, yes, sir. Yes, sir. And ladies. Good evening, Planning Commission and Planning Commission members. Obviously, I'm the rep for Fluvanna County Public Schools. We have several different CIP capital projects that we have requested for the 2020 through 2024. I'm assuming we're going to focus primarily on the request and priority ones for 2020. Am I correct?
And that's a good plan.
I can start off, or were there initial questions? I was going to run down what my plan was, is to run down the priority ones in priority order and how that would work, if that is appropriate for you. Is that okay?
That would be fine.
Okay. So let's jump in. If you look down, we have Carysbrook Elementary Roof Replacement Phase 2, $700,000. We just recently worked with the county and the board regarding getting funds to do 25,000 square feet. So phase one of that project that finished up approximately 2 weeks ago. And we just finished that project for roughly right in 245 range for 2,500 square feet. We have 25,000 square feet. We have 65,000 square feet left to do on the roof. That is why you see such a large number. We can break that up. Okay? We can break that up. So, obviously, 700 is much larger than 250. If we break it up and we extend it over a phase two, a phase three, a phase four, which we're looking at a year, a two, you're going to be spending more money. I don't have any set concrete figures, but when you talk about travel, setup, takedown of a big project like that, you're looking at every time you add a phase to it, you're going to add. I asked Mr. Wills, I said, do you have an approximate? I said, I'm trying to think. I've got smaller jobs that I've done with a dump truck here, a dump truck there. When you're talking about 25,000 square feet of roofing material and cranes, you know, you could be looking at anywhere between $40,000 and $60,000 added onto each phase. So that's why it's such a big number for 700,000. Any questions on the roof?
Yes. Is that $40,000 to $50,000 a figure that he's pretty much given you all if we broke it up like that, or that's a guesstimate?
Guesstimate. And I asked him, I said, is that a guesstimate? He said, I can't really tell you, but I know that in projects like this in the past, that's about what we're looking at.
Are we having any problems with the roof right now, or are we having to repair leaks occasionally and so forth like that?
Right.
I know that in the past we've had some places in some of the schools where we've had leaks and not gone back and fixed them, and then we end up with black mold and that type of stuff. So I just, you know, my thinking is we should go ahead and get it fixed, but that's just...
Agreed, yes, sir. So basically when this project first came on, the main part, the 25,000 square feet, was on the 100 hallway. I had been at the middle school / Carysbrook for 14 years and always had seen the majority. Water will find its way anywhere if you're familiar with water. Most of the leaks were on the 300 hallway, some on the, and you probably remember some of those as well. And then all of a sudden it found its way through the infrastructure to the 100 hallways, and it just annihilated it. On the 100 hallways with what we just did, no leaks, no mold. Air quality good. We still have leaks in some of those areas, but what we're doing is we're trash canning it and retiling it. So I do agree to go ahead and get it out, because then water causes other issues like that four-letter word we don't like to use, mold.
So this phase two for $700,000 really completes the roof.
That would be a completion project, yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Completion project.
Is there an opportunity for any state funding to help offset the cost, or DOE and Department of Education funding? Or?
Not to my knowledge. I can look into that, but roofs are something that is cyclical. We're trying to get a 20-year, 25-year kind of replacement guarantee, but they're very limited on their warranties. Very, very limited. All right, so we'll move on to school buses. School buses, pretty standard in terms of our requests.
Did you skip over April building renovation?
Well, what I was going to do is I was going to go in order. So we have priority ones, but I was going to go in priority order of how we kind of rated our priority ones, if that makes sense.
Okay, because that was a priority one, too.
Okay. I can do Abrams next if you like.
Go ahead.
All right. So school buses, obviously our second request, it's a pretty big number at 600,000. That 600,000 number has been pretty standard over the last several years. It would take care of six buses for us. We just recently were in the final stages of purchasing two special education buses, which ran us, and those were only two buses, that ran us about, is going to run us about $210,000 to $218,000. Now, they have a little extra on them with the wheelchair accessibility, but you're looking at anywhere between $95,000, $96,000 and $103,000 for a school bus. Right now, if you were able to look at the request itself, we have... 30 buses that are 15 years or older, so 2003. 19 of those are 20 years older, which is 1998 or older. And 9 of these buses are considered spares. So out of the 30, 9 are considered spares, and 21 are used on a daily basis. Now, we talked as a CIP team and a CIP committee. What we're looking at is a 15-year cycle. That's what the Department of Transportation, BDOE, recommends. I would consider that a, I'd like to look at more of a 15 to 20 year, okay? I think that's more realistic, as long as our buses are safe. As long as our buses are safe. So that $600,000 would take care of six, and as we continue to move through this process, if it is funded, we would be able to catch up, because there were a few years where we didn't necessarily get the request, and that's fine, because we're going to do, we're going to make do with whatever you give us, and we appreciate that, and the board. But $600,000 would allow us to get six new buses. Now, that's not going to stop us from requesting $600,000 until we get caught up in between that 15 or 20 year span.
Just recently had one burn up also.
Yes, we did, and that was a 2-year-old bus. So a lot of people say it's just our old buses. Well, I believe we just recently, last year, we had a 1989 bus. I graduated in 1991. My wife graduated in 1989. That bus had been on the road. I'm not going to tell her her age, but that bus had been on the road for a long time. So it's not always your older buses. Sometimes your older buses, if you take care of them, but you never know. We just recently, I talked to Mr. Wagner last Thursday. We have a 2006, so 12 years old, 150,000 miles. We're getting ready to do a CRM request. For a motor. Compression's gone. Oil's leaking. Rings are bad. But we'd rather put 22 into it instead of 100,000. So that's kind of where we are with that one.
The bus that burned up, I was at the school board meeting when the man from Blue said he was giving us another bus to replace that.
Well, he was either going to give it to us, or we were going to get it from insurance. So, yes, ma'am, we did get a bus from Mr. Schmidt and Bluebird. It was a newer bus. It had some bells and whistles on it that were fine. But we do have another bus. That bus, we are getting another bus. We should be getting it tomorrow, Wednesday. They're going to pick up their bus. We're going to get the new one.
So would insurance give you a bus and Bluebird give you another bus?
I tried that, and no, ma'am, that didn't work too well.
Because I thought
that. I tried that.
You should try it.
I tried it, and I was very excited. So when I went back to Mr. Winkler and Ms. Gillum, I said the same thing. I said, I'm going to get us two buses. And they said, how are you going to do that? I said, well, I said, the gentleman, and I clarified, Mr. Schmidt's a very good gentleman, and I'm going to help him out with his, he's doing a, what's the word I'm looking for? The word's slipping me right now. But anyway, he's going to put together a team, and I want to be a part of that team for buses. And I said, so Mr. Schmidt, you're going to gift us a bus. Gift. G-I-F-T. Not
that's,
give.
That's what
gift.
He said.
And I said, so when you gift us a bus, we can still turn it into insurance. Do what you want to do. So then I followed up with them, and I tried, and I said, I just want to make sure that I heard right. You're giving us this bus, gifting it to us. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. We're still going to turn it into insurance. Well, no. Things changed a little bit by then. And then that's when I turned it over to insurance and kind of backed off a little bit. I didn't want to get involved with that. So. But we got one. We got a replacement bus, so that's a good thing.
We got their bus through insurance.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Basically, it was either they give us a bus or the insurance would ask for them to give us a bus and we'd pay us back. So, yes, sir.
Well, I think you took more credit than you should have at the board meeting.
In that case. Yeah.
At the school board
Did he
meeting.
Take any credit? That would be more than he should have.
Well, I don't necessarily, yeah. I don't mind, I look at it more as recognition than credit. As long as he follows through with his plan, and I still can't remember the word, he's putting together a committee, but a function to look at and how we recognize all of our bus drivers. And if he does that from a state or regional level, that is a good thing for our drivers. Transportation individuals are underappreciated. Most of the time, not in our district. We try and recognize them as much as possible. But I like the recognition that he gives, as long as he follows through.
I think he should have done both.
Well, we need to talk about the CIP.
Sure. Good. I can go on. Any other questions about the buses? Our third would be the Capital Reserve Maintenance Fund. That bumped up. I know that the Planning Commission and the county have been working very hard to kind of be consistent with the $250,000. We had two other CIP projects that we moved into the CRM, so you may see where that figure is increased to, I believe it's $395,000. That was with the addition of $100,000 in a paving request and a $75,000, I believe, in a safety, kind of safety security slash project request. But we put that into the CRM so that possibly once we make it through the year, if there are funds still available, we could use those to move forward with one of those projects.
So why are we showing 250 on the one thing and then 395?
Mr. Bill, if I can just, so we put 250 on the front page of the big CIP request
right.
for both county and schools because that's been kind of the standard that the board has funded. Now, if the board decides that they want to fund the 395, they certainly can, because that's kind of what the schools and it is requesting. But we are putting right on there currently what is kind of the standard.
The brown on the second page,
we're not even
can inform your recommendation to my board. So if somebody's got 700,000 on the second page and we only have 250 as a placeholder, and you think the 700 or some portion thereof is more reasonable, that should inform your decision on what you recommend in the CRM line.
I thought last year you said that we weren't supposed to consider that.
No, not consider the individual merit of the projects, but the relative merit of all the stuff that's on there and the weight of that. If it's $400,000 or $500,000 and you think there's some meaty things there that are reasonable, then help that inform your decision on the front. You're not going to approve individual projects though.
Thank you. All right, so number four, computer instructional technology and infrastructure replacement. We have a figure of $300,000 on that. I have actually got, I asked Mr. Gifford to come. His expertise and background, he is our director of technology, and I think he'll be able to kind of give you a background, where we were, where we are, what's happened within the last month, and then how those funds would be used in the upcoming school year.
Good evening. Mr. Stribling and I were talking today, and a couple weeks ago, my Dell representative had stopped by in an informal meeting, and he was catching up with me to let me know that my data center servers had been end of life. As a surprise to me, I had no idea. He said that they had just made this decision, it was about 3 weeks ago, and that I needed to start thinking about what I was going to be doing with our division servers. These are the servers that are out of the Abrams Data Center. They cover the majority of our servers for both instruction and operations. And so when talking to Mr. Stribling today, we've had to sort of reassess what are our priorities with the CIP from an instructional technology perspective. And right now, we believe that instead of the request that we submitted here, we have to focus on upgrading our servers to something that is not end of life, something newer. The fact of the matter is we have probably 60 to 70 servers built within this data center. And these are mission critical items that have to be replaced. You have two options. You can go with a server chassis, which is multiple server blades within the chassis, and then a network storage solution, which is very scalable and flexible. If Mr. Stribling comes to me and says, we're looking at implementing this sort of instructional or operational software next year, and we need three servers stood up, I can build them out within this solution very easily because it has a lot of hardware resources built into it. The alternative is actually buying a server for every application that you need. And that takes it costs a lot more time and money to actually buy a server for every application you need, because you also have to power it, you have to cool it, you have to maintain it, manage it. We currently have a server blade chassis and a storage SAN that's been doing wonders. Actually, the Planning Commission approved it back in 13. I don't know if any of you remember, but it's been a wonderful system that we've been able to leverage for all of our items. So the bulk of our $300,000 would be going to upgrade this equipment. It would be $250,000 in order to upgrade this equipment. We could actually get everything in-house, and it would pay for both the time and the material. So it would pay for the new server chassis. It would pay for the new storage SAN. There's some other networking components that have to be used to tie everything into our data center. And then it pays for the labor as well. My guys are not skilled enough to be able to do that sort of heavy lifting. We would have to do it over the summer when school is out of session, and school being out of session is only out about 10 weeks, so we have a very small window of time to be able to get everything implemented. So it makes the most sense to contract that kind of work out and have another company help us out with that. And then the rest of the funds would be used for Chromebooks, which was our original intent of this fund. I'm not sure if any of you know what a Chromebook is, but it's a very inexpensive device if you go to market and buy a Chromebook. But we have over 4,000 Chromebooks in our school division. They're used for student instruction. They use them for collaboration. They use them for testing. A Chromebook is basically a simple computer that runs the Chrome operating system, which is the same thing that a Chrome browser is, if any of you ever use Google Chrome. And so Google is the vendor who makes Chromium, which is that operating system. They have end-of-life the support of different models of computers for about 5 or 6 years out, and so our oldest Chromebooks are now going to start hitting that end of life cycle next year. So I have a little over 300 Chromebooks that are going to be expiring, and they usually run about $250 to $300 each. So the $50,000 remaining out of the CIP would go towards it. It wouldn't cover the bulk of it, but it would at least help me offset it with the operational funds. Additionally, if there was money left over from the server upgrades, I would like to take that money and put it towards the Chromebooks as well. I know it's kind of complicated. I was trying to
so the way that
non-techie as I could. Do you have any questions?
So, what's the scheduled end of life for the computers?
For the Chromebooks?
No, for the
server. It's 2020, December 2020. And so I was looking at next summer to...
And they literally just sent that out,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, 3 weeks ago.
And what would be the...
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, they actually... They sent me a follow-up letter, and they said if you have a service contract past that day, it's now null and void.
And so my first question was, Josh, is that legal? Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And what would be the life expectancy of the new equipment?
It would probably be 6 to 7 years, which is what we've gotten out of this system as well. But at any moment, they could change their mind on that.
So if we buy these new ones from Dell, do we get some kind of assurances that we won't end of life these the week after next or something like that?
We would try our best to do that, yes.
Do they give a actual... many-year guarantee?
Yeah, usually you buy it and you get a 4 to 5 year warranty, but that is in part of the bid price. But they don't usually go out past that. Then they come back to you at that time and say, okay, it's time to renew your support. This is how much it's going to run.
Yeah. In the past, I've had some problems with it. I agree with the server part. But the instructional part, I've always had a little bit of a problem with that. I think that should have been actually in the school board budget. So some people disagree with that and so forth like that. And the way that it's set up with the $300,000 actually violates the comprehensive plan. And I've always had to wonder, how can somebody say, well, I'm going to need $300,000 every year for 5 years? How can you project something like that?
I was actually sharing with Mr. Sterling today, I've been working on a 10-year projection with every year our replacement cycles, how everything's hitting. And it's broken down into a spreadsheet, and you can see how our different computer labs, how our Chromebooks, how our servers, our, you know, all of our different equipment is going through these different cycles.
Because when they originally started doing that, they were using $600,000 for every year, and then of course they reduced it to $300,000.
They is him.
I have not reduced it. It was suggested that we reduce it because
it started at
600,000. However, we removed the infrastructure and the communications from the request, and we said we would do it as an as need basis rather than instructional technology.
Instructional. And I always thought instructional should be in the school budget. That's just my opinion. But I've always gone along with it, although I've already expressed my opinion.
I totally understand your perspective. Other communities do keep it in the CIP. If you look at Louisa, for example, they have $600,000 in their CIP for instructional technology. Charlottesville does the same. So we do have neighboring communities that do have that embedded in their CIP.
And I know we're focusing on 2020. I'm just going to put a little bookmark here, but next year's anticipated 568.
Yeah, so not fiscal year 20, but fiscal year 21, we have 2,500 Chromebooks that will be end of life. And so if you times that by 250, it's quite a large number, so over $500,000. I do have some state funds, but they would not cover that.
Can I ask a couple of questions?
Yes.
So the rates that we get for the Chromebooks, are these the costs that a person would get from Walmart, or are these the costs that are presented for school system, you know, once you buy 10 or 20 or 30?
State contract.
So that is the state contract. And then so when these, the ones that we have that are going to expire, what happens with those? Are we getting some kind of credit, or are we using that for the younger kids in the four-year program or something?
One of the vendors, CDWG, has started offering a trade-in program where you get a percentage back on the equipment and you get a credit. But we haven't gotten to that point yet. In the past, our equipment was so antiquated that people would take it away for free. But they were
end of life. We're not going to get a lot of credit.
Yeah, and Chromebooks are already considered throwaways. But the replacement cycle that we have in place is K-12, where at some point all the students are getting a new device, typically in about 5 years, and then by that time the device is end of life. And I would e-waste it, and a lot of times companies will give me some sort of money to e-waste the items, but it's, again, it's very trivial because they're trying to harvest the precious metals inside the equipment and then resell that.
Yeah. We need to move on to some other things here.
Yes, sir.
And if anybody has, I'm already the one on that.
Number five, we get to the Abrams Building renovation. It is at $125,000. I want to thank the board for allowing us and working with us to do or start renovations on one of the rooms with some of the asbestos. So we have a brand new classroom. We're going to have a brand new classroom or a renovated classroom so that we can start using it up there. It hadn't been used in the last 5 years due to not only some structural difficulties, but the asbestos as well. So the request is to continue that process moving from an Abrams Academy standpoint. It's been on the CIP for a long, long time. You know, it's going to be it's a lot of money over a long period of time. And I just think that if we're going to decide to move one way or another with it, that we keep this process going in small chunks. Not huge chunks, not $1.2 million or $2.2 million, but, and I know $100,000 is a lot of money. I get $125,000 is a lot of money. But if we're going to use that building, if we're going to, we've already put money into it, if we're going to continue to use that building, let's continue to make moves with it. $125,000 or $50,000, we'll make some type of move with it to continue that process rolling. So that's why it's at number five. Our sixth is student transport and facility vehicles. That's at 75. It's at number six on our list because now we continue. We just had a student transfer in who needs to be transported. Transferred in from another division, can't particularly ride a bus due to some behavioral and safety concerns, and will need to be transported. We can't load them into another car. We've worked with the county. We've got a great car. It makes me slow down. Not that I'm going over the speed limit. It's the Dodge Charger that sits right in the parking lot across from Central Elementary. It's got a light on it. We sit it there for visibility reasons because it looks like a cop car, but that's a car we use to transport a student to and from Charlottesville. We transport to via. If we can get that $75,000, that would be great. I think two additional cars, maybe three additional cars, for student transport, and that may be able to put on a different cycle for next year and the next five-year plan because we, it really depends on student influx too, influx and outflux. And those are, I believe, student transport, school buses, Abrams Building, Carysbrook Roof, computer instructional, and capital reserve. Were there any other questions regarding any of those projects?
Got a couple more items still, but
I do, but those are priority twos. I didn't think we were going to review those just because I put those on there just to kind of give a placeholder. They're priority twos because I don't expect, I don't want funding for them. We would love
to.
Yeah,
here?
So don't even put the twos on there.
Move it to an out
here. Gotcha.
So, I did have some questions about those two items, so therefore, the gymnasium floor at the Clement School. Which is now the middle school, used to be the high school.
Yes.
Has never been replaced. Is there, the way I've read the stuff that says
yes,
it's never been replaced, is there bad spots at this time, or is there warping, or is it just needs refinishing, or...
My understanding is that we have refinished.
No, that's a long, long time that building's been there.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We've got our money's worth. But, so it's playable. We have baseball on there. We have basketball on there. When you ask if it's refinishable, my understanding is there's not enough wood left to refinish it, to take off another, if it's an eighth of an inch or whatever they, I don't know the actual height.
So are you suggesting that they move that out to an out year?
Yes, sir.
They are not going to advocate for it this year.
Not this year.
If they're not going to advocate for funding for it this year, it shouldn't be in this year's funding request.
And then the next question I had was about the Carysbrook Elementary heating and air conditioning upgrade. My question, there were two questions I had there. Would there be less interruption to the school if that would be done in conjunction at the same time of the roof replacement? The second thing is, how much savings would the county be getting by this replacement? I know all the newer systems are much more efficient than the older systems, so I'm just wondering, and of course, you're suggesting that it be moved out.
We're moving it out, and I apologize for putting it on here. It's not even...
But, you know, that's the question that somebody needs to look at is... The savings, should we, how much more is it costing us yearly for having an older system?
So I can answer those. So the first question you asked was if we did it together. There used to be a combined project, I believe, with the roof and the HVAC because it would save us money. But some other things came up, and that's, the HVAC system is working, okay? But we just, now as far as how much money we would save with a new system, we're still finding that out with our collaboration with Dell Train, So I don't know the answer to that. So yes, we would if we combined them. We separated them 2 years ago. And I won't put the priority twos on here from now on because those are just something that I want you to look at and know that they might be coming.
So we're taking those off?
Yes, sir.
And the next time we look at this, will this be out into out the year?
Yeah, at your next meeting, we'll update anything.
Right, sir. Yes, sir. Absolutely.
For explanation, just because you've got a prior two on there doesn't mean it can't stay in this year. If you intend to try to get something funded in this coming fiscal year, it can stay on this fiscal year. And you can have priority ones, twos, and threes on there. But it's unlikely we're going to go too deep in the stack. And if you definitely are not planning on trying to do that work this year, then move it to an out
year. I'll move it to an out year. Those are the six that we discussed are the priority ones that we're advocating for this year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody have any more questions?
Mr. Stribling,
yes, ma'am.
So with the heating and air conditioning, you don't anticipate something coming out of the blue that would need to be taken care of. That's why you're going to put it into the next year because everything is working okay. The students and the teachers and staff will be all right.
Yes, and if you look at our CRM request, we have a line item there, if something were HVAC, I believe that's a $75,000.
$25,000.
Well, hopefully.
But that includes, what bothers me is that includes electrical, HVAC, electrical, and plumbing stuff, anyway.
But those are placeholders.
Are placeholders, but that's if something like that were to happen, we would look at our CRM based on how much the project is. We'd also talk with Andy, his crew, get some outside feedback. And if we needed to move, just like we moved with the county, we worked collaboratively. It was a great team effort. If something really had to happen and we couldn't fix it right then, we'd work with the county somehow. Thank you all very much.
I think you suggested that public safety go next. Is that what you had suggested earlier, Mr. Stewart?
Mr. Chairman, I also suggest we start with the sheriff's office.
Okay.
You brought a gun, John. You got it. Evening, how y'all doing? My name's Captain Wells, obviously, with the Sheriff's Office. It's the uniform. I'm new to this, so bear with me. I think we only have one fairly simple request. It's relatively straightforward, and that's for new cars. We say requesting $185,000. To purchase new vehicles, as well as another $33,000 to go with the in-car video systems attached to those vehicles. And that's pretty much a repeating request. So we've got 35 deputies, so if you figure 5 cars every year, the car has to last basically 7 years to start the cycle over again. That's a pretty grandiose stretch by the mileage we drive. It's 280 square mile county. We've got 18 patrol deputies by the very job title. They patrol. So they're constantly driving around from one county to the other. Add into that jail transports for our jail staff. We have approximately 6 jail deputies, courts deputies. Many spend time in the courts, but they also do transports, which could mean they have to go to, earlier this week, they had to go to Norfolk, pick up a prisoner, bring them back for a hearing, and turn around and drive right back to Norfolk to drop them off again. Right now I've got 2 deputies heading down to Western State and Central Virginia on a mental health transport. So as you can see, the mileage racks up on these vehicles fairly quickly. I think the last thing anybody wants is to call 911, and when my deputy's standing there, heading that way, the car breaks down because the engine overheats, and unfortunately, they don't make cars like they used to. If you could give me some Crown Vics still, I would love to have about 20 of them, but they don't make the good old Ford anymore. Right now, Dodge is the only manufacturer left that's still going to make sedan vehicles. Chevy quit making police cars. Last year, Ford announced this year they're not going to make any more sedans, so they're almost forcing us to go into more expensive sport utility type vehicles, which are about $6,000 or $7,000 more. So I think with this request, we'll probably upgrade it in future years based on the market trends. But for right now, I think this will get us at least 5 cars. Kind of quick, I know, but kind of basic as well. Anybody got any questions on that, or I'm happy to answer what I can for you and let you know kind of the details. I'm the one who builds most of them, or buys all the equipment and try to coordinates it all and deals with the warranty issues and maintenance contracts and all the other fun stuff.
Basically, I've heard this over and over again. So
it's a reoccurring request.
A real problem. Also, you do have up here upgrades for the courthouse security.
Okay, well, it's not given that one. What do we got?
Courthouse security upgrades, $75,600.
I have absolutely no idea. I've got nothing to do with that project.
I believe
that it sounds very important. Nobody wants to.
No, Captain Hills only submits these. Captain Hills on a cruise ship, lucky for him right now.
So I was going through the notes.
Wasn't it some actual upgrades?
Yeah, it's an upgrade. I'm familiar with what it is.
That's some of the older.
It is. I can tell you basically the.
They're not digital type.
The brief version of it, that's exactly accurate, sir. I believe it was.
I think I read that.
I believe a year or two ago we upgraded part of the security system. When they did that, they tried to integrate some of the older, and I'm not a tech guy, the older analog based cameras with the newer digital and IP camera system. And I think some of those cameras have now ceased operation, so there's some areas that aren't functioning as it should be for coverage. So my understanding from speaking with the sheriff, I just was unaware this was denied, is that that cost is to upgrade for the entire new package to finish off the project that they just tried to finish the first time, where they tried to do a little crimping and save and use some old equipment as long as it was still feasible, integrate it with the newer stuff. But I think it's also for the door lock and some cameras to put all new stuff to replace the stuff we didn't replace during the first upgrade. I know it was a little vague, but.
So when I see that you're on the spot, and so, but you know, just talking from the sheriff's office perspective, you talk about security concerns, cameras and locks and those things. You know, you have citizens trying to take their legal business. This funding here, would that make the project whole, so that everything would be the way that it needs to
correct.
Be?
Correct. It would all be up to relatively modern standards. The old stuff was here when I came here 12 years ago. So they tried to integrate. I know they went the Bosch system, which is a very nice system for the majority of it. The exact percentages of what's old and what's new, I don't know off the top of my head. But yeah, because you got to remember, it's for the courthouse. So that's a public building that's open to everybody. And it's not just to secure the public. It secures the staff members as well. Believe it or not, there's a lot of angry people sometimes when they leave that courthouse or when they come to pay their tickets or anything else. So a lot of that monitors the clerk's offices, both upstairs and downstairs, circuit court, and general district court, as well as the surrounding parking lots. We've got a one PTZ, pan tilt zoom camera that'll reach actually the park out front here that far, and also to the parking on the side. We've got some more in the back. And we also, for the Sally Court area, I believe there's some issues with the doors on the Sally Court. Does everybody know what the Sally Port is?
Yes.
Okay, I just want to make sure. I think there's an issue right now with that door that's covered in there where it's not functioning properly. I think part of the upgrade is to make sure that door and the remote door access system is functioning
properly.
It was properly.
Also the automated fingerprinting system.
For the interface?
That was part of the thing. The functionality of court security does allow for automated fingerprinting of OSDs while at the courthouse.
Okay, to address that, currently we have one. Does everybody know what APHIS is? Okay, good. Yeah, well, on time.
Where she works, she probably knows a lot about it.
I understand.
Copy that. Anyway, so we only have the one system right now, and that's the sheriff's office. So anytime a prisoner needs to be fingerprinted, we have to, again, take a deputy off the road, bring him over, go to the Sally Port, load him up, take him back to the office, and bring him back over. So part of that is you get some security issues during the transporting, but also it's a staffing issue as far as labor costs. Where if you had the machine there, I mean, it basically looks like a small hand scanner. You can knock it out there in 10 minutes and save exposure time as well as payroll time.
And you talked about the analog cameras that go out actually under a power outage. And your type was...
They're hooked to a USB or backup battery, so they work better. Again, sorry, I don't have the exact details. Sure, you're talking about the car, it's not the security.
It's a pretty modest request.
I think so, too. For what they're asking for, I think it's pretty.
Any other questions I can try to wing for you? I appreciate y'all's time. Thank you so much.
I think what we'll do now is to start at the top of the page and then the...
we got the fire and rescue.
Well, that's right.
Well, hopefully y'all...
I'm trying to get hurried on because we only got 15 more minutes left, so...
Okay, well, I'll make this as quick as I can. Thank you for your attention. We have several things on the list this year. CPR assist devices, self-contained breathing apparatus replacement, second phase,
First start of the heart monitor replacements, and then the vehicle apparatus, which is the biggest one. NFPA specifies a 20-year life cycle on fire apparatus. We have an 8-year cycle on ambulances because they go out and get a lot more mileage. There's a tanker in there that's 20 years old, the tanker 10 that needs to be replaced. There's an ambulance that was in actually last year's request and got pushed back to this year, so it's a similar to that one. And then the water rescue vehicle that's in there, this is actually the third time it's come up. It's actually a 1991 vehicle, so it's well overdue for replacement at this point. Questions on apparatus? Okay. The other is the CPR assist devices. Mr. Nichols very generously found a way to purchase one as a pilot project for us this year. And this is to equip the other trucks at Lake Monticello with these CPR assist devices. They're basically a mechanical device that does CPR for you. So if you have a two-person crew, you can have one person driving, one person attending to the patient, and then this does the CPR. We, as I said, we have one as a pilot project right now, and it is spectacular. We've used it on at least 6 patients already, and that's only in the 9 months that we've had it. So the problem is if it's out on the first due truck and that turns out to be a nosebleed and the second due truck gets the cardiac arrest, we don't have the CPR assist device on the second truck. So we would like to have all the apparatus standardized that way if possible. The self-contained breathing apparatus, these are the masks that the firefighters wear when they go in buildings. The current ones are end of life and need to be replaced. Without those, we will not be able to fight fires. The idea, it's a big project, so we put in half the request for this year, this fiscal year, and the second half for next fiscal year, with the idea that we'll buy them about at the changeover time to try and get them standardized, but split it into.
Only shows in 1 year here.
It was actually in last year's, but it was only partially funded, and then the second one is in.
There's a total of 500.
That's the second half.
97,907.
So. Is this the grant?
Yeah, so the SCBA really only what was funded last year. Last year we had $100,000 that the county was going to put in and the same $497 that we were hoping to get a grant for. The grant fell through.
We just found out that
so basically all that is funded for this project right now is $100,000. So there's going to have to be some serious
going
back
to the
drawing board.
So we need to leave the $497 off?
Well, no. For this year, they're going to reapply for a grant for this fiscal year.
Because, okay? I mean, I'm looking at what it shows on the paper.
That's county funds, sir.
Yeah.
There was $597 last year. $100 in county funds, $497 in potential grants. It's not listed in that prior year column, but that's only county funding from last year.
Yeah.
So we had $597 last year and $597 this year.
Okay,
But the grant did not come about.
We were applying again for.
So did we buy?
We're reapplying.
Did we spend $600,000?
No,
we did not.
No. So we've got $100,000 earmarked for it.
It's open right now.
Okay. And that's it.
So it's due in the end of the month.
If they apply for the grant again and we don't get it, the county's going to be on the hook for. Well, I mean, they're going to have to come forward with a real good estimate for what's going to be needed because, I mean, right now, for the 2 years, we're looking at like $1.2 million. So,
We need to fight the fires and we need this type of equipment, then you know.
Well, yes, I mean, do you need $1.2 million or is there another figure that's more appropriate?
Right.
But it is something that will have to be addressed, absolutely. So the grant is due, the reapplication is due the end of the month. And
October 26th.
Yeah, the end of the month. So we're working on getting that application in right away. The heart monitor replacement, it's a similar issue. Those are being end of life in 2022. So we're planning a phased replacement of those over the next couple of years. So this is phase one of that. These are the monitors where you do an EKG on the patient in the field. And we already talked about that. And so the last one on there, which is the priority two, is upgrading some of the hydraulic tools for the jaws of life, cutting cars open. That's a priority two, just because we've got so many other things in there.
We are also applying for grant funding to supplement part of that, and we actually did get that grant. So we do have some funding to partially offset.
Now, the jaws of life that we have now, do they need to be replaced now? That's the question.
That's why it's a priority, too. They are not absolutely essential to be replaced at this point. Part of the issue is with all the fuel mileage changes, and the manufacturers are using a lot of high-strength steels now, and the older ones struggle to get through them. So whereas it might take 5 or 10 minutes to get through with the old tools, the newer tools that are designed to go through that might go through it in 2 to 3 minutes. The other issue is the old tools are all hydraulic-powered. The new ones are battery-operated, so there's a lot more mobility, so you can get into places that's not quite as easy as with the hydraulic tools. You're limited by the length of the hose. Any other questions? I know I went through that very, very quickly, but you've heard some of it before.
The 80K of the system, Mr. Chair, can be 60K and 20 in the, we'll put 20 in the grant column. So it'll be 60 and 20, not 80.
Right.
What were the two vehicles you were proposing to replace?
That's actually three.
Three.
One is an ambulance. That's for Pulvana County Rescue. One is a tanker 10 at Station 1, Palmyra Fire Station, and the third is a water rescue vehicle.
What is the water rescue? Is it a boat?
No, it's actually a truck that carries things like ropes, tows a boat. This one is actually designed to have a compressor on it, so it can fill scuba tanks in the field, but it's also support the fire departments as well. So it'll be designed to fill the self-contained breathing apparatus that the firefighters use if they have a long involved fire in the field and they need to have tanks filled in the field. So this is actually designed to support the fire departments as well.
Well, anything else? On these hydraulic tools, real quick, one question.
Yeah.
In other words, you're saying if we had these new types, if we go to a wreck,
yes.
The person would be able to, you would be able to get the person out much quicker than with the ones we have now.
Yes, sir, that is correct.
And they will be more mobile because they're battery operated.
Absolutely, yep. So if you have a wreck that's down a hill back into the woods, it can be difficult to access at this point, whereas you can take a tool to it, it makes it a lot easier to get to it.
And when you're purchasing those equipment, because you said it was battery operated,
yes.
Is all that stuff included or that
yes.
stuff?
Yes, that's all included in just on the gear, yes.
Any more questions?
The ambulance that you're requesting, where would that be located?
That would be at Station 1, Palmyra, just around the corner here.
Same as the tanker.
So one's at the rescue station,
both,
one and one's at the fire department. But yes,
both
these are both for Palmyra. That is correct. Okay. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay, we only got about 5 more minutes left, so... Mr. Nichols, do you make a suggestion? Who?
Probably Wayne's Public Works.
Yep. This is a new one, but it sort of crept its way towards the front as being a relatively important project. Unless we're going to accelerate funding for another one that's in here for a combined administrative services and school admin building. But even so, if the executive and main administration of the public works department ends up at the new admin building, we still need office space at the maintenance shop, which is, it used to be the MACA building, and before that it was a maintenance shop. Public Works, I think, and before that it was the shop class for the high school that was at Perrysburg High. I'm proposing an addition to the building, probably a metal building, as inexpensively constructed as possible. This project also includes the addition of some parking spaces, which are at a premium down behind the building, especially now that both MACA, well, and the county and the new food closet buildings are down there. They've got a lot more traffic for that as well. And it's kind of part of a little master plan for facilities, general services and public works type things down there at Carriageville. It's a relatively centrally located place, part of the county, and it's a good sort of headquarters for your public works facilities and general services programs. So this is, about, I think, for pretty good, about $325,000, including engineering design, site planning, site development costs, and construction costs.
One note on that, one offset on that would be, once that project was done and public works moved on there, we'd be selling that building on Main Street, where public works is now. That's part of the aim here, is to get rid of the
The
non-commercial housing type of houses that we're building now, we're working now, we want to sell those off on Main Street. So it becomes something commercial or residential for tax purposes, not for county buildings.
And those kind of dovetail into the idea of, you'll see in a little while. Right now, it's a category or a ranking three because we've just got to push way out into the future. Not going to cost anywhere near as much as a high school, but it's still not inexpensive at all to build a new admin building out at Pleasant Grove. I think there was a master plan at one time that called for there to be a combined municipal building out there near next to the sheriff's office, and that's kind of what we're envisioning here. That would also help the schools by allowing them to just sort of leave the old Pymoller school, which is in either dire need of a lot of
And that's still work scheduled for 2024?
Well, it's not necessarily even scheduled, sir. What it is, it's a placeholder in there that we put out in the fifth year. I would love to see
How much discussion has the actual board supervisors had?
A lot over the last 10 years because it was part of the master plan 10 years ago. And every year it comes up again. We'll bring it up again this year. And the board wants to move it towards the front. They can if they don't want to, then at all.
We're going to be working with one of our engineering firms to kind of do a space need study just to determine what our future plans are for the county, for the buildings that we have, and see if it can be more cost effective to have all these old buildings that, you know, spread out or something more consolidated at some point. And like I said, it's in the out years for this board. This is a discussion piece.
But the building we were actually talking about, the equipment shed and so forth like that, that's a 60 by 25, five stall.
Roughly, yes, sir. And that could potentially be constructed in two phases. One, basically building a shelter, a cover, almost like a pole barn type thing, like the picnic shelter out of the Pleasant Grove Park, to park the equipment under cover and then walling it in at a later time. But in any event, it's intended to be non-climate controlled. We've got two tractors, a dump truck, mini excavator, a Bobcat skid steer, and various other utility trucks and other equipment that are outside all the time. The tractors in particular don't age all that well when they're just stored outside uncovered. And so we're looking for
snow plows and trailers and all that.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. All that stuff right now, when it rains, it all gets wet. Snows, it all gets covered with snow, and
it has to tell you that
just ages have, faster.
We're going to have to wrap up because our regular meeting starts
that'll
here
be fine.
In about a minute.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I suggest we do the rest of the discussion on the business in a regular meeting. The further discussion of the CIP with the agencies that are here. So we, next month can be devoted totally to rain.
Okay. You're suggesting.
Can we move it to unfinished business on a regular meeting agenda?
Okay. In other words, we'll move it to unfinished business after we do our regular business.
Correct.
Okay.
Which we won't have tomorrow.
We don't have basically a whole lot, so we should be able to get there that very quickly.
Mr. Chairman, if there's no public coming for those, there's no public hearings for things,
we can even move
it. Whatever sequence you want.
Yeah, we can even move it above the site plan, officials before the site plan.
Because I didn't know whether anybody was here for that site plan or not. So
I believe there's applicants in the hallway.
So,
yeah, they're in the hallway.
I mean, they're here for our regular meeting, and that is a scheduled item. And I think we should go through that order, and I think we could go through that very quickly and then get back to this. just to, well, the public convenience, I mean, they're here for a regular meeting. Okay. Make a motion that we call the work session to close and add additional capital improvements plan work to unfinished business after we finish our regular meeting item.
Second. You don't really need a motion for that.
I just wanted to make sure we had to. Okay, now 7 o'clock, our regular meeting of the Planning Commission for October the 9th is now in session. Our first order of business is the Pledge of Allegiance, followed by a moment of silence. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. The next item is director's report.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any board actions to report from the previous month. Mr. Nichols did send me an email this afternoon. TJPDC is requesting that a member of the PC or the Board of Supervisors part of a new regional housing committee, which discusses housing issues within the TGPDC region. And I just wanted to gauge your all's interest in one of the members here becoming a member of that committee. It's supposed to meet once, twice, maybe a year. Mr. Nichols is going to bring it up to the board to see if there's any board members if it's their prerogative for a board member to attend. But we are gauging interest within the next month or so to see if a PC member might want to be part of that.
I think what we need to do is to let the Planning Commission people think about that, who would might be available to do that. I'm not available to do that, but after the board, if somebody on the Board of Supervisors wants to do that, then we should give priority there, and then if not, then we should be somebody that is willing to do it for the Planning Commission could be a backup.
That's all I have for this month.
Okay. The next item is public comment section, one or two public comment sections that we'll have tonight. Anyone wishing to come forward to speak on anything in the county, please come forward, state your name and address. You will allow to be 3 minutes. Seeing no one coming forward, we will end our first public comment section for the night. We'll go right on to the minutes of the September 11th, 2018 meeting. Does anybody have any comments, any corrections, or does anybody have a motion about the minutes from September 11th, 2018 meeting?
Make motion to be approved.
Have a motion for Mr. Johnson to approve the meeting minutes of September 11th, 2018. Do I have a second?
Second.
I have a second from Mr. Lagosino. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye, 5-0. With no public hearings tonight, no presentations. We do have a site development plan. SDP 1808, Virginia Electric and Power Company. In your package, it might show 1803, but the actual number is 1808, and that's been corrected on the screen. And the paper, if you got a copy of our agenda.
Did any of you desire a hard copy of the site plan?
I don't need one. I've looked at it.
I'd like to see that. Okay. I'll go back. Thank you. Good.
Okay, this is a site development plan that's been submitted by Virginia Electric and Power. This is a request for sketch plan approval to construct a new substation, which is classified in the zoning ordinance as a major utility. It's going to be going on property identified as tax map 58A57. The parcel was originally 73 acres in size, but they have cut off a piece that is going to be 26.930 acres. That is the portion of the property the substation will be located on. And as you'll see on the map, the property is zoned A1, and it's located within a rural residential planning area. So that's the location of the property. There, you can see its proximity to Route 15. And then this is a copy of the plat that was approved by the planning department showing the 26.93 acres that was cut off. So the smaller size portion to the right-hand side is the newly created parcel. And it looks yellow on the screen, but the color should actually be a light green. That's just showing the zoning, which is A1. And then this is the sketch plan submitted by the applicant. This is just the main site plan. The site plan, of course, the full set has the additional sheet. This shows the layout of the substation. It's going to be going, basically, it's going to be a fenced area that will include substation equipment and a ground road to access the equipment. So that area, portion of the property is going to be approximately 555 feet by 447 feet. That's that portion of the property that will be fenced. Inside of that, a gravel road will go around the perimeter, and then inside of that, all of the substation equipment. No buildings, parking areas proposed as part of this project. And then, of course, the substation doesn't require any utilities or septic. So to conclude, this is the sketch plan for a major utility. You should recall that there was a special use permit approval a few months back. So this is just the follow-up process. They got their special use permit approval. Now they have to get their site development plan approval. So that's what this is before you tonight. The site plan appears to meet the requirements of the ordinance. So if you were to grant approval tonight, then they would just need to submit a final site plan for final approval. Staff recommends approval subject to the three conditions in the staff report. And that concludes my presentation. A suggested motion is on the screen, and a representative from Dominion Energy is present if you have additional questions.
Motion?
Yes. I would move to approve SDP 1808, the sketch plan request to construct the transmission substation, major utility, with respect to 26.930 acres of tax map 58, section A, parcel 57, subject to the three conditions listed in the staff report.
Okay, have a motion from Mr. Zimmer. Do I have a second? Okay, have a second from Ms. Mary Key. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye, 5-0. We don't have any subdivisions tonight. The next item is unfinished business, where we're going to go back and talk more from some of the people about the capital improvements plan. So I reckon we will go back to, does Public Works have any more?
covered the addition to the maintenance shop to offer more office space for the public works and general services. This is a lot less money, even if the public works facility had to be put off. We think it's very important that we get that done, that this done this year. We do need to cover storage for our equipment. The next one is water system, Pleasant Grove. Right now, the uses at Pleasant Grove are served by a well that's out next to the multi-use playing fields, otherwise known as the soccer fields to some people. That well also serves the high school with water. The high school actually built a small treatment plant, per se. I think the water is actually treated to more or less soften it and make it easier on the boilers and evaporators for the high school's HVAC system than it is treating it for being drinking water, because it already meets drinking water standards when it comes out of the ground. This kind of folds in with our ongoing plans to try to get public works facilities and or God forbid we end up in the utilities division, our utilities division to take over some aspects of things that the schools currently cover. Yes, sir.
Is this out in 2022? There's nothing for this coming year?
That's correct. I don't need to discuss it tonight if you don't want to. I mean, we just put it off mainly because
in our discussion tonight, do we really need to?
No, probably not. And move on. We already briefly discussed the combined administrative services and school admin building.
What about the historic courthouse?
Yes. Basically, the board recently allowed us to move some funds that were in a previous CIP item for repairing exteriors of buildings and put it all into the CIP plan for renovating the exterior of the historic courthouse. That left us about $55,000 short of the budgeted, total budgeted amount to do the entire job. So we're asking for that $55,000 in FY2020. And subject to the amount of grants, donations, et cetera, that the Flubana Historic Society can come up with, some or all of that money may very well be returned to the county's CIP pot, if you will, at some point, either during FY2020 or subsequent to it. But this basically, I was probably fixing to ask for, we have $100,000 on it before?
What's
we had about
$100,000
from before.
So 75 and you had
$125,000. We were asking, getting ready to ask for between $125,000 and $175,000 to fully fund this, but with the shifting of the funds from this other CIP, which was more or less either obsolete or complete, that brought us down to only needing $55,000. And as I said, any amount that even of the original amounts that were approved that we get, that can be offset by grants, donations from whoever will go to offset the cost of the actual project. It's important to take care of that whole courthouse. It's getting to be in pretty rough shape on the exterior. Columns are deteriorating badly. Obviously the wood and the trim has deteriorated quite a bit. And as important as that building is to the county, it's also actually an important building from a historic standpoint statewide. It's one of the only, or maybe one of only two, I think, remaining courthouses from that era that have not had some kind of exterior addition, remodeling, or changes done to it. It is basically in its original state from 1830 when it was originally constructed. So that's the pitch on that. And the only other thing I wanted to bring up, right, I guess, and this is part of the MRR plan, but it's pulled out and put on a separate line item, much like the schools and the sheriff's department. We have a fleet. We do a fleet replacement plan. I might have thrown Jason a curveball. I wanted to discuss that one, but look at that. What a quick recovery. The last 3 years in the county CIP, the regular administrative side of the vehicle fleet replacement plan has been either severely underfunded, and I know for the last 2 years it's been funded at zero. As with, and I'll go ahead and put in a pitch for the schools and the sheriff as well, as with any other fleet replacement plan, when you zero it out, all you're really doing is putting off your expenses. Using the school as an example, if you have 90 buses in your fleet and you have a 15-year life expectancy, you need to be replacing 6 buses a year, because over 15 years, that's 90 buses, and you just rotate and rotate and rotate. The first year you don't fund 6 buses, you fall behind. You may come back the next year. In a couple of years in a row of not funding it, you may come back and say, okay, well, we're going to fund it, fully fund it this year, we'll get caught up, but you won't be caught up, because if you only fund 3 buses 1 year, and you need to be funding 6 buses a year to maintain a 15-year life cycle, what you really need to do is fund 9 buses the following year, or you continually fall behind and your vehicles get older and older and older. Now, we're in pretty good shape. Despite being underfunded for a couple of years, we're not doing too bad, but we do need some money this year, and so I put it in as $200,000, which was a little bit more than you might have seen in FY 2020 when it was an out year, because the assumption at that time was that we'd be getting the $175,000 or whatever it was that we were asking for. I've kind of reshuffled my whole fleet management plan.
County fleet replacement section under okay. Public safety.
If you look at the descriptions on the back for when, and I've consistently done this over the years, is for the upcoming year, the one that we're planning for, 2020, I'm very specific in the vehicles that I'm trying to replace. And in future years, I basically just name numbers of vehicles that we'd be looking to replace in that year. So we are, each year right now, falling a little bit further behind in our fleet replacement plans. I have to thank the sheriff's office, because they've actually handed down a couple of relatively good condition vehicles, one of them being a Crown Victoria, which I think you might want to have back, right?
I'd steal it back from you.
I'm going to come looking for it.
But I said that. But the goal when I first started work here on trying to get the fleet in good shape was that we wouldn't find it necessary to be handing vehicles down from one position to another, because theoretically you use the vehicle up and where it is, and then you want to kind of get rid of it, replace it with a new vehicle that's going to have much less maintenance costs. If you do it right, you kind of balance it out to where you've got relatively new vehicles, very serviceable vehicles, but your overall cost is running at about the same as it would be if you were trying to maintain and do engine rebuilds and things like that in old vehicles. So I would appreciate a recommendation of at least some funding for my fleet replacement plan.
Question might be for Mr. Dahl, but why did the social services get its own line on this thing? What's the purpose for that?
Well,
for its vehicles?
Well, yeah.
I can answer that, actually.
Yeah.
They can get partial state funding, I think, for some of their...
So in the past, there's been sometimes where social services paid out of their budget. If it falls out of their budget sometimes, I think they can get some reimbursement some years. The only reason we broke it out into here is because they wanted visibility for the vehicles that they want, even though Mr. Stevens kind of oversees all their vehicles and maintains their vehicles. We could just as easily roll them all up into there, but then I think you might get an agency coming to the board saying that they want to make sure that they're getting vehicles.
There isn't anybody from social services here tonight, so I'm not going to give you my opinion about their vehicles when they're not here to defend them.
This is recorded, so it would be a bad thing to do.
No, we have been talking, and they have been very, very reasonable. They had, I think, 10 vehicles in their inventory. And I'm regularly down at Harrisburg to be a shop to see guys, and I have never been down there when there's been fewer than 5 social services vehicles just sitting in the parking lot. And when we started looking at maintenance records, at one point they had a vehicle that had 17 miles put on it in the 6 months that we scheduled between oil changes.
And that, and was, so, that was a 1999 Cavalier and Sultan.
And I've, what I've been working with them on is trying to determine exact how many vehicles do they need. Because the idea isn't to have everybody have a vehicle at their disposal the second they want one. The idea is to cover 99% of the time. So if every once in a while somebody has to use a personal vehicle and put in for reimbursement, and that's not happening more than, say, a couple times a month, then you've probably got that fleet, that particular portion of your fleet, pretty well balanced. And what we did is, this year, they did drop one. They are currently running with 9 vehicles, not 10. We got rid of one without replacing it, and we're going to see how that goes. If they continue to have very few miles on vehicles between oil changes, we might be looking at dropping down to 8 until we hit that balance point.
So but, they had, we dropped them down 1, and now they're asking for 2 to bring it back up to 10?
No. We're actually, there's 2 different things going on.
Replacing the vehicles.
There's 2 different things. They do still have some very old vehicles in their inventory that need to be replaced.
Just as county does, just as the schools but do.
They were originally scheduling things to maintain 10 vehicles in their little mini fleet out there. What do you want to call it? I kind of talked them into doing 9, but that still means that they do have a legitimate need to replace 2 vehicles. They have aged out, if you will. They're either aged out by age or by mileage, probably by age.
I think their next oldest one is like a 2005 or 6 Ford Explorer or something like that.
So, again, those vehicles are not part of my computations. But yes, I will say social services, that they have the need to replace their older vehicles, but we are trying to kind of figure out what the best number of vehicles for them to have is. So, that's the story there. It's
you're trying to figure out how many employees actually need vehicles. I know that certain employees have to be on call 24 hours a day to support like that.
Mr. Chairman, I just, for full disclosure, I am contracted with social services, so as we talk about.
Okay. Do you use their vehicles by any
chance?
I
do not.
Okay.
And Ms. Eager's on the social services.
I'm not. I don't know exactly how many people they have on call. All I can tell you is observations over the last 6 years. I've worked here for 6 years. Is that there has never been a time when I've been down at Carey's Room when there hasn't been at least 3 or 4 local government tagged vehicles sitting in the social services parking lot. So
maybe and another time you and I could have a talk
about. Absolutely. And as I said, Mrs. Mays has been very open to discussing it. Obviously, she's defensive about her vehicles and wants to make sure she has enough for everybody, but she's been very agreeable. And as I said, we're down to 9.
See, I don't know if they share vehicles or they're all each assigned a vehicle.
No, I do know that. They actually check out a vehicle when they go somewhere, so I don't think any one person is assigned to a specific vehicle.
I think, though, we just have to be clear what state law requires in terms of insurance and using those vehicles to transport people's children and family. And then, so when you talk about, and I'm going off of what I'm hearing, the 17 miles, whatever that looks like in terms of checking out, signing out those cars and those vehicles so that we can have a total, and I'm just making this number up, this is just 3. It's 3. We have to make it work, but we have to be mindful of, like, he said, talking about having on-call people and how that
absolutely
works. So I just wanted to make sure that portion was clear, because if they're not using their own vehicles and they're using ours, would we be asking individuals to use their own vehicle that may not meet the insurance and things like that, that they have to in order to do those transports?
So somebody actually should look at the logout sheets. Mm-hmm. Figure out how many vehicles they actually need and how often they need.
We do it by the mileage, the usage, how often they're checked out, things like that. Obviously, on a 24-hour on-call thing, theoretically, all 9 vehicles are sitting in the parking lot. So if somebody's got to go out and do something in the middle of the night, they can go to the office, check out whichever vehicle they wish to have, unless somebody's out on an overnight trip or something, and go take care of their business. And I am by no means trying to short shrift anybody for the number of vehicles that they actually need, but the county's budget is always tight, and we don't need to have a bunch of vehicles on the books that we aren't using and are utilizing. That's all. For the first time, I'll move on from vehicles unless someone has any more questions. Now, for the first...
I did have a question. Oh, okay. You spoke earlier about offices and the maintenance shop. My question would be, and I don't know what the county rules are, and certainly our attorney can talk about this, but when we have, like, let's take this room and we needed two offices, is the county staff permitted with the training and certifications that people have in construction to just purchase the material and build a wall here to give us two or four offices in this
yes.
space if
we okay, we actually do that sometimes. Okay. Most of the time our staffing needs elsewhere for grounds and so the other things don't allow it, but sometimes, say, during the winter, we've constructed to do some office divisions. This actually is an addition of space. We simply do not have enough square footage to provide offices for everybody that needs an office, so we're looking at doing an addition. And I did include a sketch and a layout of the planned building in my submissions. I don't know if it made it through to the packages. I don't know how much it did. But I always send back the material, and if anybody wants to see that, I'll be happy to show it to them.
Sure, thank you.
For the first time, I've given an equipment budget. I'm trying to do a similar thing with our equipment fleet that I do with our vehicle fleet, and that is determine what type of equipment we need. And we are still short a couple of pieces of power equipment, not heavy equipment per se, that I think that we need and would be useful to us. And so for this year, I put $55,000 in there for another skid steer. The one we have is aging, and it gets used a fair amount at the landfill, but it also needs to be used in other places. So my intention was to permanently station the older one at the landfill for the use there to keep the driveway and the burn piles good, and then have a newer one that's just a bit more reliable for us for our general construction and repair and other needs. And then the towed or accessory equipment is actually a lift, 65-foot lift, that tows into place, puts out outriggers to support it, and it will allow us to save money, because we'll change our own bolts and things like parking lot lights. Right now, I got to wait for about five or six of them to burn out before it to be economical to come in and have a contractor replace them. We can theoretically replace them one or two at a time if we have our own forces doing it. But off this day, a lift like that is also helpful in cleaning out gutters, checking roofs for damages, cleaning the sides of, you know, the power washing buildings and other things like that. So I did not really have time to flesh out the out years, but for this year, I'm asking for $105,000 for those two specific pieces of equipment. And that's it.
Sir, could you tell me your name again?
Wayne Stevens. I'm the Director of Public Works.
Okay.
Yeah,
you
know,
thank
you. Very often. I see you every once in a while, but I don't pinpoint meetings very often.
Thank you, sir.
I am also the county engineer, so you may start seeing me more often on things like subdivision plans as development and growth starts to happen. Part of my job as county engineer is to review things like subdivision plans and site plans from an engineering standpoint. I just haven't had that much of an occasion to need to do a whole lot of it lately.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Did anybody have any questions about anything that I just submitted or discussed?
All right,
thank you.
Thank you. Oh, man, I would have said you had to be like this. Oh, no, I'm good. How are y'all doing this evening? So if we're just talking about FY20 CIPs, I have two to talk about today. The first one I'll talk about is the Pleasant Grove Playground expansion. It's trying to get a piece of ADA equipment on our playground so that anybody in our county can use a piece of equipment in our park. We currently do not have an ADA accessible piece of equipment in the park. So it's just to try to add a piece of equipment so that an ADA accessible kid or young adult maybe could come out and use a piece of equipment.
And if I can chime in, we don't have an ADA accessible piece of playground equipment at Harry's Brook or at the community center. We literally have none in the county.
As a county parks and rec department. I think the schools have one. Maybe two pieces, but that's all we have in the county. So that's my first request is a piece or two playground equipment. And then my second one is a spray park, a spray ground. I don't know why I can't say that. So that'd be, you know, down towards the Stockville area. It'd be a spray park for kids to come and place to get wet. And we don't have the money for a pool, so this is like an alternative to a pool in a way. A lot of people use it, and I've heard good things about them, you know, through Charlottesville and everywhere else. They're less maintenance than a pool. I think you got to check them about every 2-3 hours. Other than that, they're low maintenance. Recycled water goes in the ground. It's made. That's how they're made.
Where's the water coming from?
It'd probably be the well. It'd probably be the well down there.
So a lot of the water is recycled. I noticed for many years, a couple of my grandkids went to school at Yancey, and they had spray ground right across the street.
Mm-hmm.
Little park there, and I noticed that it got a lot of use, and it looked like to me it took very little maintenance.
It's low maintenance.
And they lived in that area, so I was passing by at different times too, and so forth like that. And it looked like to me it was a great thing. The kids, I'd sit there and watch the kids, playing it. It looked like they had a great time. So,
we already have people on staff, and I can't keep loading stuff on people without adding people, but we'll be adding some more utility staff as Sign Crossroads comes along. We've got people who can do the required water testing and even mess with a little filtration. It has a filtration system.
And a lot of it goes through their home. They have sensors on them now, the people that put them in, so they'll be able to tell if there's a problem, you know, like at the building, wherever their sensor's at, and they can contact us to go take a look at it, kind of thing. So. Those are the only two I have for this year. I don't know if you want me to go through any of the out years or not. That's totally up to y'all. I can if you want. I didn't think so, but I can.
I'm not missing anything. What is the cost for that actual spray ground?
I have 150, I think.
We just did some interviews with some of our county engineers, and there's a couple of firms that actually kind of highlighted a lot of spray ground parks. And you know, they were talking, you know, anywhere between 150 to 250,000 was kind of the range for something to do, and those are becoming a lot more popular in parks nowadays, just because one, the liability with pools, the maintenance, the upkeep, and
your staff. I mean, look at how many staff you got to have for, you know, lifeguards and stuff like that.
He budgeted 150, so what we build will be on the small end. However, these things are generally very easily expandable. So
you can add a piece here or there, you know, the out years.
You can spend another $75,000 to add on to it.
So is this 150 for the small piece, or that's for the?
It's for
a relatively smaller piece. It won't be a huge piece, but I've tried to get something for people to use. So if we can start small and grow, that's great. I want to get something out there for them to start using, and we can grow it as we get a chance to. But I mean, I think it'd be a great addition in the community. There's no outside pool that people can go to in this community except the lake. Really, in Fuma, I think are the only pools, and Camp Friendship, but you have to be a member there. This is a place where people can go hang out and picnic and get wet.
That was the other question I was going to ask you. Seeing that Lake Monticello has, you know, tried to open up the restaurant and have these kinds of opportunities for individuals to use services, has that ever been a conversation about the county? From the county being able to get something similar to that, access to their pool?
I have not gone through that with them. I have recently gotten county teens access to go to their clubhouse for a teen dance that we're having twice a year. So we're working on the lake allowing outside residents to come in to do stuff through Parks and Recreation. But I haven't, the pool is not my pool, you know.
I know. I have membership to the pool.
You maybe.
I was just at a Lake Monticello meeting recently, and you can buy a membership.
It's like double.
I think it was $843 a year to use Lake Monticello facilities. Now, that doesn't include the pool. I live at Lake Monticello, and I still have to pay an additional membership to the pool if I want to, which I don't.
Okay, I just was asking.
Okay. Yeah, no, but my department, we're trying to start working with Lake a little bit closer to use some of their amenities for our residents. They're actually letting us, again, go on the lake for canoe kayak training and stuff like that. And they kicked us out, and then I talked and we worked out.
Have you read the rule of decision about the
they didn't
allowing people?
Yes.
And the discount
stuff. So, I mean, I live at the lake, so I'm trying to get outside residents to be able to use the lake. I live there, and I think there's a lot of amenities that don't get used that can be used. So that's my opinion. So. I also think they should have a Parks and Rec director at the lake. Not me. I love my job here. Not me. Is that it? Do you have any questions?
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you.
Is that everybody?
That's everybody.
Well, I thank y'all for coming tonight. Appreciate all the information y'all give us, and appreciate all the work that all of y'all do for the county and so forth like that. We're going to agree, we're going to disagree on stuff, but looking at some of it and stuff like that. Like the spray park, I like I said, I had some video looking at that, and I think it's a great idea. So.
I think we're available if anybody has any questions about anything that we presented. I'm off just up the street. And just drop by or call me, and I'll be happy to sit down with one or more of you at any time.
Okay, if we have any additional questions, I think next month we'll be ranking.
So if we're available, come on back, and questions come up as we rank them.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Moving on along. The next item is new business. We're going to be talking about the club cluster subdivision discussion. And Ms. Holly Steele, our newest planner, will be bringing us in.
Should I sit? It's probably easier.
All right. Here's fine. All right. So we just wanted to introduce the topic and maybe get the discussion started about making some changes to our current rural cluster regulation. I'm not sure how familiar all of you are with rural clusters in the county. I've been informed we have some rural cluster experts here. So just for your information, the purpose... The purpose of the rural clusters is to promote the preservation of open space and rural character of the county, while at the same time accommodating growth and protecting the value of the property. We do allow rural clusters in A1, R1, R2 zones. As you can see up there in the A1 zone, one dwelling unit for 2 acres, and then you can see the setbacks plus those of the R2 zone. R1 and R2 are pretty similar.
The
difference there is R1 is one dwelling unit per 1 acre, and then R2
yeah, no, I appreciate it.
Per 1 acre. And then this is just a list of the existing rural clusters we have already. I highlighted Foxland because it does lie within the Zion Crossroads CPA, and that will be important as we talk about this. And I'm not sure if it's really relevant, but maybe it is worth mentioning that the Meadows, is that the one you said, Brad? That one was vacated in 2017, so it's up there because it was approved, but it's not. It has been developed in it. So. So with this, the main issue we're having is, do we want rural clusters in areas that may be better suited for other ways?
Yeah, the background of rural clusters was sort of mandated by state law in regards to localities growth rate at one time, and they stipulated that you had to have 40% of your agricultural residential zoned property in the county or community eligible for rural cluster subdivisions. In Pluviana County, it's 100% of those areas. So
that was based in 2004 when the state mandated cluster subdivisions. So
it was around that time period.
County.
Yeah, but it's like a growth rate of 10% or more.
10%, based on the prior year's census. In other words, at that time would have been based on the, no, that would have been based on the 1990 census. Because the most recent one would have been in the 2000, because that was 2004. So it would have been based on the 1990
comparison of 2000.
So, no. It was based on the, well, there was a 10% growth based on this, on the 1990. The way I read it, I've been reading for the last couple of days trying to figure out, and of course I've seen where there have been some changes in 2006 and 2011. I had one other question for Mr. Payne, was the fact that as we go forward, do we look at 2000 census to see if we had a 10% growth to see whether we required, or do you still go back to the 1990?
You mean the 2020 census that's coming up?
If you read it, it says the prior census.
That would be 2010.
Right.
Last census was 2000.
I know that, but I'm talking about
one before that was 2000.
Yeah. Okay.
What they were talking about is a growth rate.
Yeah.
So they were measuring from one census.
It was like 2000.
Because in 2004, you were basically off the 1990 census.
1990 to 2000. That's right.
Comparing the two censuses.
That ain't the way I read it, but anyway.
Sensei.
Regardless, our growth rate has drastically dropped.
Yeah. Well, we were at that time we were the number two growing county in the state.
I'm sure if you compare 2000 to 2010 today, the growth rate
much less.
Yeah,
would not it's be right around 2%, as opposed to 10 plus 15, 20, 30%.
Do we yes, because living on the county. 4,500 lots, and it's built out. So once all those lots were going,
you were having 500 so lots well,
that's one
per
reason.
Year.
That's one reason. I think this is my non-professional, so he's going to hit me when I say this. My assessment is that there have been a lot of changes, cultural changes, I think you could say, that has affected demand for housing in rural areas. And if you go to Charlottesville, for example, go to Albemarle County, both Albemarle County and Charlottesville, what you see is lots and lots of infill development. Right? So you have areas in the city, for example, that were, well, I don't know, 10 or 15 acres that were totally undeveloped. And they've been developed now with really quite dense housing. Townhouses, single-family houses, but there's small lots that really weren't selling before the bubble burst. People were coming out with, I want to go buy my, 10 acres and put my McMansion on. The market has really changed, and you can see it
since 2000.
Well, over the time, I don't know if you draw a bright line, but one thing that I was talking to one of my partners about the other day, she follows the real estate market, and one thing that's changed is the size of houses that people want. So that in 2005, for example, there was a big demand in Albemarle County for 3,500, 4,000 square foot houses. You can't give those away now. People don't want them because they're too expensive to maintain, and people just by and large don't have as large families as they did. So a 2,500 square foot house is a pretty big house today. In those days, it would not have been so much. But there's a lot of that that I think, again, I'm not a professional on this, but if you look at it, you'll see what I'm talking about. Go to a place like Belvedere or Briar Road, if you know where that is. That's very much different than it was 10, 12 years ago. Much denser. And I think there's a lot of things that go into it. Gasoline prices, for one thing. Proximity to workplaces.
Yeah.
Okay.
I moved out of downtown Charlottesville. And even with the chaos in city government, the price of houses downtown is astronomical. And it's purely because of the unique location. Or all these purely large because of that. So I think what you're going to see is over time, our growth rate will probably increase some, but not dramatically. That's why Meadows, is that what it was called? That was one of the early 2000s developments that was sort of mini Spring Creek. And they didn't get it started in time is what happened. So there's now a conservation easement on it. There's one up here, but is there one up
on Poplar Ridge?
Poplar Ridge. There's a conservation easement on it, too. That kind of housing, just the market has changed.
Well, many of the buildings went bankrupt as well.
Well, that's true. That's true, but that's not, I don't think it's a big driver, because what's happening is that the, let me back up from that a little bit. In my capacity as a private lawyer, we have a client that developed a couple of pieces of property in Greene County and had a really nice single family development in Greene County. And it's about two-thirds developed, and they're having tremendous trouble finishing it out. And they're saying that the people that are coming, that are interested in lots, are not talking about $400,000, $500,000, 3,500 square foot houses. They're talking about Ryan Homes, things like that, that would be much less. So that's one thing that's my view of the market. I think for the foreseeable future, this is a trend that's probably going to remain fairly steady. Ms. Eager can tell you how long it's taken to sell out Two Rivers.
About 10 years.
Yeah.
Well, actually, we started it before the 2008 crash. So it's probably
one of our main discussions tonight is about whether to prohibit them in certain areas.
That can be an option. We put two different options up here that we've talked about. Overlays, like it says up there, is like an additional layer of zoning. Jason has some experience with that in Dinwiddie.
What Dinwiddie County did was they strictly followed what the state mandated, and 40% of the land that was eligible for cluster subdivision, they went strictly by it. About 40%, and they limited to the corridors, their main growth corridors. That's the question: as we are developing Zions Crossroads, and we really want to have that open up the cluster subdivisions.
What, 75% open space?
Yeah, would that be the best right. use? And further, do we want to further rein that in other areas of county?
Well, there's another way to do that. Our ordinance already provides for cluster subdivisions in other residential districts. It's a different density, and so the uses are different. But there, you could have an R2 cluster, for example, and that's better suited to a growth area. I don't know that that's been a big problem. My perception is that it's not. I will make no bones about it. I think the rural cluster is a spectacular success. I live in one, and it's, I find it to be very attractive in a number of different ways. And it does preserve rural character. If you drive down 616 in front of my subdivision I live in, you can't see it. It's not visible from the state road.
That's an interesting point about that, because the surveyor that we had wanted to take the road straight up the and start the houses. And I said, no, I don't want to do this. It makes more sense to curve it around so the houses won't have to be seen from the road. And they said, well, you're never going to get that passed by VDOT. And what's his name? The older gentleman. Anyway, he went out there with us. He says, that makes perfect sense to me. Draw it out for me. And my husband, you know, had a piece of paper, and he said, I'd like it to go like that. He said, I like that. So,
if you want to see how rural cluster works, in my opinion, the way it's supposed to work, Two Rivers is a very good example. It is slightly more than 75% of it is. And I will tell you that I was prejudiced against the whole concept because that was one of my favorite hunting land. And so that's gone now, but now I live there. But it's
70% to come here, sure, a problem.
It's 75% open space, and it's designed, and this is Eager's doing a lot to a large extent, is basically a ring and then a large area down by the river that's in the nature of a park. So there's one cul-de-sac road that goes in, serve 28 lots. And I think if you go in there and look around and talk to people, you'll see it's an unusually successful design.
Each of the houses is backed by the open space. So they all have, you can walk out your back door and it's essentially your farm.
You could walk the whole perimeter of the subdivision and not get off the open space.
Can I ask a question? On open space like that in a cluster subdivision, when that open space is designated, there's no requirements for maintenance of that 75% open space of any type?
Well, there is.
Well, you mean county requirement?
Yeah.
There's no county requirement, but...
covenants up from the subdivision.
Yeah, and I would say it's typical to have covenants that provide for it. Ours does. Mm-hmm. But it's one of the things that's attractive to me about Two Rivers is that you're living in the country, and that's the way it's maintained. So you don't have a lot of bells and whistles. We don't have a water park or whatever you call it.
Have the wonderful access to both the Rivanna River and Newchunk Creek. And when you go down there, it was all overgrown, and I had it certain trees taken out and opened up that space so that people can use it more as a park. And you have access to the river, a little sandy beach there.
And people do. But it is well designed in accordance with our ordinance. But it shows it's a good example to my mind of how well deserved subdivision comes out of these ordinances. It would be possible to develop the same property under the same ordinance. It wouldn't be as successful. Like as Trish was just saying, with the entrance road, it goes in. In my house, for example, I have neighbors on both sides that are 50 feet from my house. And there are only two windows in our house where you can see another house. There's one on each end. And other than that, you can't see another house from the inside of my house. Now, I think that's kind of remarkable because the lots are like three-quarters of an acre.
This came out of because I had helped. I was on the planning commission at the time we did the cluster subdivision, and when I decided to do this, I wanted it to be what I had envisioned our ordinances meant. Because some of the developers just want to use a part of it, and they don't really think about how it's going to integrate with the community that it is.
Well, it does. The ordinance does have some restrictions on how to develop it. One of them is that you have a very substantial setback from any exterior road. So I think Two Rivers does a particularly good job of integrating that into the open space, shielding the homes from the outside and shielding the roads from the development. So if you're driving down 616 and you don't know it's there, you just think it's another patch of woods.
It does have a sign out front.
Oh, you have a sign, but that's it's the kind of sign that you might see on
a farm.
Yeah, a farm or somebody has a nice house or something like that.
So what would these potential amendments or changes seek to do? I do understand not taking up 50% or 75% of a subdivision's property with Zion's Crossroads community planning area and leaving that as a big chunk of open space, because we hope hasn't come to fruition yet, but we hope that land will be used for industry, business, commercial, some maybe development.
And it would be more better for like multifamily type of thing in that area if the industry and commercial uses came there a lot of times.
So where would we seek to put this stuff? Where would we seek in your vision?
I think generally we'd want to steer as clear as Zion's Crossroads as possible.
The CPA.
That's easy.
That's the easy part. The other issue is how well are they working in other areas of the county? I can think of three or four examples of horrible cluster designs that are problematic. The streets aren't being taken in by VDOT. Do we need to take a look at where we are allowing those? Is it working out well? Do we want them clustered more in our CPAs or within the perimeter around our CPAs? Or do we want to just leave our rural conservation areas open to them?
Are you able to tell us where the examples aren't good? Does that contradict something?
I think the biggest one that comes to mind is Needham Village. I mean, Needham Village is...
I think it is.
Well, the one that calls Rogers ex-mother-in-law
is
the I don't even have any idea what it's called.
Which one?
It's only seven houses in a... One that's up the road from me.
The one on Antioch.
Yeah, Antioch Road. And
Antioch something.
Yeah. No, that's a different one completely. This one is just a small seven unit thing, and the open space is it's just left to grow a tree here and some. It's kind of.
We just had one proposed that's been withdrawn on Carysburg Road.
Yeah. So I don't know what it
was. Our comment.
I can't remember what the name of it is. But it's right up the road from me. Matter of fact, I own land across the road from it.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to have some visual comparison.
Yeah. It's.
I'll tell you. We used to use a term, you don't want it to look like a ghetto in the middle. You have a large lot.
I'll tell you one that you can, I'll tell you if you want to see one that's another design is Sycamore Square. That's off Slice Gate.
And is that a good option or not a good?
Is that a cluster?
Not all of it.
The back part is.
Yeah, the back, the face for it, of course.
And so is that, it strikes me that I see Needham Village appears to be right at Lake Monticello also, right?
Right.
And it strikes me those are areas where we're looking for denser. We are looking for density and not necessarily vast open spaces.
The goal is to preserve rural character of the county.
Sure. That should be sealed at Lake Monticello. We're not preserving the rural character there.
And again, that's why I did with the county limited to their agricultural areas, but they were corridors.
Right.
They're not popping up all over the place, but you still have a kind of strategically placed to where you can't have 10 of them in a row, right. As opposed to commercial, lack of services, and I saw what happened to Chesterfield County by playing a residential group without commercial services. They're playing catch up right now. So this is, as we get that growth pressure from Almar, are we going to be a veteran community, or are we going to have a tax base?
I also think we ought to have some more variety of ability in development, since we really can only do clusters. And, you know, if you get out into the much more rural areas, it's kind of nice to have more open space between your homes.
And that's true. We want to look at coming up with some sort of other idea for how you can do a subdivision in agriculturally zoned areas.
We talked in a committee one time. We talked about having these, 10-acre type subdivision thing. We had a name for it when you and I was on that committee that time.
Yeah.
Like 10-acre minimum lots, minimum size.
Yeah,
lots.
And it was it a state type subdivision?
In my opinion, you don't want to go too far like Goochland and have a state.
I think that's the most destructive thing you could possibly do.
Okay, I'm just
take more and more land out of it. Working like other forests or
agriculture. You're going to end up pricing out the locals.
Yeah,
so let me put it in context for you. Take 104 acres like you had a few rivers, and you had 10-acre minimums, that's 10 lots.
But all that land is not going to be farmed.
All of that
land. It's not going to be managed forestry. Nobody's cutting their trees. So
right.
Now it's a 100-acre subdivision. It's just like a subdivision, except it only has 10 houses.
You know, I had experience with that. Oh, well, 20 years ago now. For some reason, it escapes me now. I was at an Albemarle County Planning Commission meeting, and I was there early, and I just looked up the map that was up on the plat that was up on the front of the room, and I said, "That's looks like a perfectly conventional subdivision." And I was looking at it from a distance, and it used the whole parcel for whatever the number of lots it were. And it just, it was just subdivision lots. But they were 10 to 25 acres apiece. It took a 600-acre parcel and devoted it to nothing but residential lots. In my opinion, this is my personal opinion, I think that's a terribly destructive form of development.
I agree.
And you were right on the answer to the question you gave me a while ago.
What was that?
When I was talking about the census type thing, it said, next to the latest, decennial census year.
That's what I thought you said. I thought you were saying the question is, were we going to have the meeting adjourned before the Red Sox game starts? you got 6 more minutes.
On that note, we just wanted to start the discussion because we'll probably bring in some more scenarios to you all more in depth.
I very much think that they think about Science Crossroads. We really need to look into that because, like I said, that is not only a CPA, it's more of a designated growth area. It's where we really want to concentrate on bringing businesses to that area.
Okay.
Of course, as that develops, probably closer to that, you may want housing for people that actually want to work in that area.
Well, one thing about an area like Zion Crossroads is that you need to bear in mind, and that is the county, the county can influence development patterns and encourage some, discourage others, but at the end of the day, development's going to be done by the market.
Right.
And you wouldn't need to worry about a rural cluster subdivision in the Zion Crossroads area if you had demand for commercial and industrial area on the same land, because the land would be too valuable. And that's...
But we can do some things to
make
that happening now, kind of help preserve that land for when industrial.
You can, and you are.
Yeah, that's what we need to be doing.
one of the things you've done is that
the strategic zoning initiative?
The rollback taxes.
What's the phrase?
Overlay.
Something zoning. It's the thing where you can, I've got 100 acres that's zoned A1, and it's obvious that it's not going to be farmed indefinitely. I'm going to go buy put 3 car dealerships on it or something like that, but I want to keep it in land use until I do that. Before we amended the ordinance, if I had it rezoned, let's say C1 or industrial, the LI, If I had it zoned I1, as soon as it was rezoned, I'd lose my land use designation and be subject to rollback taxes. What the county's already done is to make it so that you don't have that. So I can take my 100 acres of A1 land, get it rezoned I1, for example, and market it as I1. I'm not subject to rollback taxes, and I can continue to farm it until I sell it. And when I sell it, I've got plenty of cash, and I can pay the rollbacks.
Substantial.
It is very substantial. And that's one of the things the county's already done. And that's a logical way to handle it in a place like Zion Crossroads. That idea came, as I understand it, out of Hanover County. Mm-hmm. And I happen to have a daughter who lives in Hanover County. And if you go there and look at it, you can see that Hanover County is a fast-growing county. And they are not growing the way we were. This is an ongoing trend because you run out of Henrico. Richmond's still growing and Henrico can't accommodate it. So if you're on the north side of the river, you're in Hanover or Carolina or wherever you are. So there are ways you can do it, but I wouldn't want to kill the golden goose because there are places that it would be beneficial to have clusters, even if there are R2 clusters or R4 clusters. So don't think that there's only one kind of cluster. That's not true.
Anybody that's interested in the state code, that's 15.2-2286.1. And that's the original modifications done in 2006 and 2011. And they do talk about roads and so forth, too, in part of this.
The county was already looking at the cluster concept when that statute was adopted. And that obviously gave a lot of momentum to its being adopted. I think the concept, which was largely accommodate a reasonable amount of residential growth but preserve the rural character of the county, I think has by and large been very successful.
Well, I feel more encouraged tonight, actually, Ms. Steele, hearing this, being able to ask the questions that I'm asking, because the perception of how the county moves forward, I don't know. Maybe there's a lot of information put out there and people just can read it, but understanding where the decision makers are coming from in the decision making process, there's one thing to be said about the comprehensive plan, the CIP and all that, but people are busy. All they see is what the final result is. So when I hear you talk about the ways to be able to accomplish maintaining the rural aspect, considering the industrialized piece of it, you know, because I'm not from here. I'm from a city, and there are just aspects that just has to, you know, flow. And so knowing that you know, this team here, this board, this considering that the board of supervisors is looking really at that way and not closed off to those opportunities is pretty encouraging. And, you know, this conversation here is what allowed me to hear what I needed to hear about the move forward of the county in which I live.
Well, back in 2004, when this was adopted and so forth like that, and I think Sam Babbitt had a lot to do with some of the stuff, because I heard you thank him for some of his input on that back after I came on the Planning Commission in 2008 and so forth like that. But I think right after that, as I looked at a lot of stuff, a lot of these cluster subdivisions that we have, and some of that on paper was a rush to do them in 2004 and 2005. Am I wrong there?
No, I think you're right.
I can share this with you. At the time, I was on the Planning Commission with Dr. Babbitt, and one night he said, I think we should not allow anybody to divide their land. Whatever you have tonight is all you're going to get. I went home that night. It was December 29th. I think it was 1999. I said to my husband, I can't take it anymore. We've got to call a surveyor and divide our farm with the ordinances that we're allowed to today. And I did that. I did it in such a way that it still was big, big lots, so because I wanted it to stay in land use, because I couldn't afford to keep it if I didn't have the land use. So we did that, and we never sold any of it until now. And now that we're older, we can't maintain it all, and now we're beginning to sell those lots. And at the time, it had to be 2 acres on the road and 10 acres off, and you could only do 14 lots per division. So on those large parcels, like the Haddon Place, that was, I think, 200 acres or more. And it's not the way I would have liked to have developed it, but that's all I could have done. And today, you can't do what was done then. So there are some large lots, there's 5-acre lots along the front, because they had to be 5 acres to stay in land use. And then the rest of the other 14 lots at Manhattan Place, there's one that's 82 acres, 22s, 24s, because I wanted also, when someone else bought it, if they had 24 acres, they could still keep it in land use, because they'd take 2 acres for their house and the rest would be pasture. And they sold the historic house that's there that was built in 1790s maybe to a woman, a mother, her daughter who's 31, and her 3-year-old granddaughter, and they all lived there, and they have horse people. So it worked out really well, because they just fit that house beautifully. And so anyway, it does affect people very much. But what's said in my meetings, I mean, I don't think Mr. Babbitt knew that he was the reason I did that, but it was just a sign of the times, and I thought I'd better do it while I can.
One thing, I mentioned Sycamore Square. Sycamore Square has been a thorn in the county's side, because there's been some litigation over it that
won't stop.
Like a vampire. But that's an example of one of the creative things about our ordinance, because our ordinance does not require common open space. And it was specifically designed so that you could take 100 acres, divide 25 of it into individual lots, take the 75 acres, and keep it as one parcel. So if you had the family farm, you could continue to live on the family farm, sell off those 25 acres or 24, because you have to.
Yeah.
You could do it that way and maintain the farm. That's happened in a couple of instances. Sycamore Square is one of them, because the way it worked out. That's the way the developer wanted it. This person that sold it to him had some other ideas because he didn't read the ordinance or something. But
it wanted the subdivider open space.
Yeah.
But I mean, but that residual 75 acres or whatever it is, that is forever undividable.
Oh, right.
Well, as long as the zoning remains.
Right.
And
So that's right. So if you go there now, what you'll see is there's one house on it. And I haven't physically been down there lately to see what it is, but it's undeveloped with a number of lots toward the front.
If you go to the cul-de-sac, you'll see kind of a break in the houses where there's a little driveway to a straight back, and that's the open space.
Been very key. Yes. A lot of this is the fact that on these clustered subdivisions, say you had 100 acres. If you divide that by two, you come to 50. So now that's 2 acre lots. And you could basically put 50 houses on 25% of it. In other words, on 25 acres, and then you had 75 acres in open space. Of course, you do have to take out the roads and so forth like that, so it doesn't actually ever come out to 25, right?
Exactly.
Because of the steep slopes, that's what I only got 28 lots on the 100 acres, even though the ordinance said I could have.
Because you can't count the deep slopes as part of the.
And the water area, wetlands, which because of the.
That's all. I've been reading that ordinance this week, and I've seen all of that in there. Yeah.
We as a staff just think there's been enough of a sample for us to circle back and take a look at and see what's worked and what's not worked.
Right. Make some reasonable.
I agree.
That's all we had tonight. We were just wanting to start a discussion.
Thank you. Now, Holly, you just need to write an ordinance tomorrow.
So. Okay.
Yeah.
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 Thank you, everyone.
You learned that what he just has said is not possible. A lot of people that come for us of things like that, and like at the last meeting when I was talking about the dates when we started and so forth like that, and I didn't cover that with my head. They were sitting right there in front of me in the package. So if anybody thought I just knew that out of my head, well, you were wrong, because I would read what Mr. Robinson had put in the package and so forth. So, but I wanted some of the people that were in the audience to understand the process that we had to go through, because some people think that you can just wave a magic wand today and it's going to happen tomorrow. And it does not. I mean, you've got to go through looking at the audience. You've got to go look what other counties did. Then you got to talk to Mr. Payne about the legalities and stuff like that. So sometimes if you rush through something, you create more problems than what you really want to solve.
And I don't know if it's the Planning Commission has done this before or, you know, something in terms of the future. I don't know how many people present to the staff about, you know, purchasing and doing projects or whatever the case may be. But, you know, if this committee, and I don't know who has to give the authorization for that, but having basically an overall training session about what the Planning Commission does and doesn't do, so that time isn't wasted. Or when you
flew out of leadership classes that they have, goes through a lot of that, and use a lot of times somebody from the Planning Commission, sometimes the staff at one of their meetings goes there and talks to them about that.
Well, see, I was one of the persons early on in that class, but I'm talking about as a whole, because some people, because of their lifestyle, their schedule, they can't follow the class portion, but by us trying to just let people understand the community and what's going on, a mere question prompted by something I asked Mr. Payne resolved some of the concerns that I had just understanding people's roles here. I know what's written on paper, I know what's written in law, but as a team, what direction are we trying to go? And I think that it would be beneficial to other people in the county if we consider at some point holding some kind of, this is what we do, this is what we don't do, and allow them to ask those questions irrelevant of them trying to get a project passed. I'm just asking the question. And
you know,
we had some experience with this in Bedford County, didn't we, Mr. Robinson, where the Citizens Planning Academy?
Yes.
And
that was a little bit more. One thing you find, I've said this, you know, I've been looking at this business from both sides. So I represent developers, homeowners, as well as local governments, and I've been doing it for well over 40 years. And one thing that has always, one principle that I've always believed is the county's objectives are best served by professional developers that are acting in their own interest. Because they can read the ordinances and read the comprehensive plan and understand what the county's objectives are. And they're not in it to make, you know, nice grid lines, square lots, and get in there and whack it up and sell these lots for, you know, $4,000 a piece, move on. They want to maximize the profit. And they maximize the profit by, at the end of the day, maximizing their sales price. And they do that if they're attractive in the market. And so the typical developer that we were seeing years ago was Joe Blow that owned 50 acres, and he said, oh, let's get a surveyor and put a stob here and go 200 feet that way and put another stob. Real amateur kind of stuff. The market is much more attuned to something more sophisticated than that, and that's helpful. So that the average citizen doesn't understand the process because it's a sophisticated process. And even in Fluvanna, which is a very simple, we have very simple rules, the staff is very helpful. They don't understand it because it's a sophisticated process.
And we've only had zoning in the county for 44 years.
But to Ms. Murray King's point, I think, you know, we see people come in and they don't understand the process of just this meeting. They want to come up here and they think that their public comments are an opportunity to ask us a bunch of questions. So that's a misunderstanding. And I think they also, you know, what we saw with the thing with the pool house at Lake Monticello, a lot of those folks seem to think we were here to enforce the homeowners association rules. So there is a lot of not understanding of a lot of things related to county government in general, and the planning commission in particular. So I'm not so sure there isn't a value in having some kind of informational
session. But that's also what people come, the civic minded person will come to a meeting to learn too.
It will, and I was going to say, let me finish. So my point was going to be, one, I think that would be of value. But I'm going to predict now that nobody will come. That's my prediction.
Let me just say.
But I would be willing to participate in it on the off chance that somebody did.
We used to have more participation for the first 2 or 3 years that I was on the Planning Commission. People came to our meetings, and
y'all were just making people mad back then, Mr.
But that was also because there was a lot of growth in the county.
Actually, I think it was a lot of friction, actually, partially in the Planning Commission, as well as some of the people in the...
One thing, maybe I should just leave you with this. I no longer really do much conveyancing where I come in and mom and pop are buying a house and I'm the guy that writes the deed and goes through the closing and stuff. But when I was doing this on a regular basis, I would have a closing with mom and pop, who were just ordinary people. They weren't developers or anything like that. And I would take lots of time going through the documents. And they have restrictive covenants, were there easements on their property, what did the zoning permit, what did it restrict, stuff like that. And you would go through it in excruciating detail. And when you got done, they had no idea what you just said. And I had that happen dozens of times where people would come back and say, well, can I put this gazebo in the back of my yard? No, because there's a restrictive covenant that says you can. Oh, I wish I'd known that. And I don't mean to be talking down to people, but that's a fact.
Well, you think about our most controversial public hearings we've had in the past 5 or 6 years. You see, you know, 50 people in the crowd, but when that agenda item's over.
Probably Poppy Ridge was the biggest one.
It's almost right. Like you have to wait for everybody to clear out.
The training center was and a big deal a couple months ago, too.
The training center.
Poplar Ridge, and then the thing about the water.
Yeah, training.
They would probably
they're not sticking around for the site plan discussion on you know, Dominion Power.
If we're not going to have any more discussion on that, should we continue on with the meeting? And the last item in the meeting is the final of two public comment sections. Anyone wishing to come forward, may come forward and state what you want to speak to the Planning Commission about. It will be limited to 3 minutes. Seeing no one coming forward, we will end the last public comment section. If there's no objection from members of the Planning Commission, we will adjourn at 8:27.